I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 211 of Caro Pop. If you'd like to throw us some support and help keep this thing going, please go to caropop.com. I first saw, interviewed, and covered this week's guest more than 30 years ago, guitarist, singer, songwriter Dog Julin.
Stupid me, stupid you.
This was the early 90s when I was covering local music for the Chicago Tribune, and Julin was fronting the power trio, the Slugs, alongside his brother, bassist Greg Julin, and drummer Mike Halston. Dog moved on to join a bigger band, in multiple senses of the word, after Poi Dog Pondering relocated from Austin, Texas to Chicago. Julin is featured on their albums Pomegranate and Natural Thing, and has played more recent reunion shows with Poi Dog as well. This conversation took place a few days before Julin hopped a plane with his Rickenbacker guitar to perform REM songs as a member of Michael Shannon and Jason Narduzzi and Friends at Wilco's Sky Blue Sky Festival in Riviera Maya, Mexico. Next week, Julin and that band begin touring to mark the 40th anniversary of the REM album Life's Rich Pageant, just as they did with Fables of the Reconstruction last year and Murmur before that. Julin performs his own songs with his Chicago-based trio Sunshine Boys, now prepping material for its third album.
Big words, little man, undermine, don't understand, conqueror, divides the land, soft void, tiny hands, you succeed, and we are damned.
He also can be found around town playing fun, unpredictable covers with the bands Expo 76 and Courtesy Patrol. And he plays guitar in Sonic 45, a quintet that performs the songs of bassist and Chicago White Sox radio play-by-play announcer Len Casper. Julin has a reputation as one of the most valuable players around, and many fans are happy about how in demand he has become. He talks about all these projects here, including the enthusiastic reception for the Michael Shannon Jason Narduzzi REM band. Is this a tribute band or something else? How did that amazing photo of Julin with Michael Stipe come to be? Julin also tells the Sunshine Boys' origin story, co-starring bassist Jackie Schimmel, and drummer and previous Caro Pop guest Frieda Love Smith, with drummer Gerald Dowd, a more recent addition. Why the name Sunshine Boys? Why did they all share songwriting credits? How did they, quote, unquit the music business? Then there was the time when EXTC, the band led by former XTC drummer and previous Caro Pop guest Terry Chambers, had just lost its lead singer, and I tried to get Julin up on stage with them. Julin, after all, had sung and played XTC songs with Tributosaurus. If you've hit any Chicago clubs, you may already have interacted with Julin, one of the most amiable, knowledgeable, and talented musicians around. And if you haven't, well, please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Dog Julin.
And I believe that I'm tripping through time. I believe that I'm tripping through time.
That picture of you and Michael Stipe in Athens is like one of the most amazing pictures.
It's pretty cool.
It's so delightful. Like, because yeah. Your expressions are really great too. It's a really sweet, warm photo, aside from making it look like you guys are like brothers.
Well, yeah, it was a really good night. It was after, I guess our second of two nights when we were there, or maybe it was the first tour, but it was a party afterwards. We went to have a late night pizza party with the band and us and their management and a bunch of other people. And it was great. And we were hanging out in the kitchen, and I've been told so many times that I have a resemblance to him, and he was very gracious about it and laughed. Like, I just asked him if we could pose for a picture, and he was absolutely accommodating, as they all were.
So, he didn't come up to you and go, "It's my doppelganger."
No, not really. No, he didn't do that, but he did acknowledge, you know, that we kind of had a similar thing going, and we were kind of dressed. We had scarves, and I don't know. We looked a little bit alike that night. So
you're like his tall brother.
Kind of, yeah. Yeah.
A tall, somewhat younger brother.
Yeah. Not that much younger, but yeah.
So, and you're just about to go off to Riviera Maya to do Sky Blue Sky with Michael Shannon and Jason Narduzzi and the gang on sort of the big Wilco Hard Rock Riviera Maya winter festival, basically. So what do you do to prepare for that? And how much of, is this like a job, or is this also like pretty good?
gig?
It seems like something that I've been doing in my free time for the past 3 years now is, you know, immersing myself in REM songs. And it really kind of just feels like we kind of just wrapped up our last bit of touring, you know, in the UK and stuff like that. So I've got to prepare for not only the upcoming tour of Life's Rich Pageant, and then a bunch of other items from various points in their career. But I'm prepping for this gig in Cancun, which is an amalgam of a bunch of things we've already done, basically. So yeah, I'm sort of learning two full sets, or relearning, you know, a set of music. So it's a lot of work, but it's really good. I'm very happy to be doing it and making sure that I get it right, you know.
Right. So it's, yeah. So are you kind of like in, obviously you're in work mode at some, I mean, I don't know when, I didn't look to see on the schedule, like what day you guys are playing, but at some point, is there like vacation mode also down there?
Yeah, we'll get down there. I think we'll get down there on Thursday. We play Friday at midnight. We'll have a practice. We have arranged a John Starrett from Wilco, who's playing bass with us, has arranged for us to find a place to practice.
Nice.
One practice. And then yeah, it'll be kind of a couple of days of vacation. And there's some stuff I definitely want to see. And it'd be nice to get a little sunshine in the middle of winter here. So it's, I'm good. Excited about that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good time to do it. Plus, you get to see other bands. So
yeah, I mean, Yola Tango's playing. There's a bunch of other things that I'd like. I've never seen Jay Maskus or Dinosaur Jr. I don't think I have. I might have seen them at the Metro.
I don't know that I have either. I shouldn't
100
that,
years but ago, but yeah.
Golden Smog was just up here, and I missed that. I've seen them before, but it's been a long time. But I saw they're on the bill as well. So.
Oh yeah, Jayhawks, I think, are on there.
Yeah, Jayhawks too. So, yeah. And then you can Wilco three nights if you want. That's all.
Yeah.
That's all good. So, is this going to be the sort of the beginning of the Life's Rich Pageant tour, or like, are you going to play that album in full, or are you going to just do a bunch of REM songs, but sort of be like, you know, working those Life's Rich Pageant songs in, because obviously you're going to be touring that.
For this set, no, it's not Life's Rich Pageant focused at all. It's really a collection of things that we've done before in the various tours that we've done. There's no focus on one album.
There's no like album you're playing beginning to end like you did on these other tours.
When the tour starts, that's what we'll be doing. But for this gig, with this Wilco gig, no, that's just a collection of songs.
Does that make sense? Do you guys all get to sort of throw out, like, do you get to make requests? Like, you know what? I'd love to do this REM song.
You know, I don't think I've done that yet. Jason and Michael work on that. And then they, you know, send it off to us, and then we begin the work, you know?
So are there new ones that surprised you aside from, you know, obviously having to learn Life's Rich Pageant?
Yeah, there's some stuff on there while I'm not at really liberty to disclose anything, there's some stuff there that falls into REM sort of more atmospheric period, which I think is satisfying, really satisfying listening, and fun to get my kind of my head into this kind of stuff and listen. You know, we will listen to the albums and base our versions on the albums, but sometimes you want to hear a live version to compare it, to see if there's any adjustments they've made to what they might not fully be able to replicate from those kind of elaborate studio recordings.
Well, that's part of what was cool seeing Fables of the Reconstruction live, because I remember, because I'm old enough, that I saw that original tour, and I love that record. I really do. And I don't have the complaints about it that the band, some members of the band seem to, just about the murky sound and everything, which I understand. But I also, that was like a show where when I went to see it live, I was like, oh, Life, you know, Life and How to Live It just totally explodes on stage in a way that it doesn't on that record.
Yeah.
So seeing you guys do all those songs live, it was like, yeah, this is, you know, it's a great opportunity to hear what they should sound like in a sort of less murky, you know, mix.
Yeah, that word comes up a lot with that album, the murkiness, and
I still love it.
I love it too, and as a matter of fact, I got a whole new appreciation of it for it. Listen, you know, learning these songs and playing them every night, and I think we might have been at that same show. Was that at the UIC Pavilion?
I was in Philadelphia at the time. I was in college. So I saw him at the Tower Theater in Philly. Yeah. The first three times I saw him were in Philly at Irvine Auditorium, at Penn, at in the fall of 83 with Let's Active and Pretty Poison opening. I like one of those bands, and it was not the one with the flaming batons. And in fact, I'll just promote this anyway, although sort of in retrospect, but the episode that's going up on Thursday is Mitch Easter and Don Dixon about, because they just put out this, they didn't, but Interscope just put out this one step of Chronic Town and Murmur together. Yeah. So we kind of go down memory lane of them recording that. And there's like some stuff about the recording of that record that I had no idea about, even having talked to both of them before, that just sort of blew me away. So there's some good little nuggets in there.
Well, Mitch Easter came and played with us during the Murmur tour, and he was just such a great guy. It was so nice. And we all sort of formed a semicircle after the show in the dressing room, basically cornered him and just peppered him with all sorts of questions about the recording of those things. And he was really gracious with information and answering our questions. And to that extent, also REM themselves have been really open. Like we can text or call Peter Buck or Mike Mills and ask them about, you know, is this a minor chord or a major chord? And you would get these little insights to, well, Pete's playing a major, but I think it's a minor. And, you know, these little kind of funny behind the scenes, you know, bits of information about the band. So that's been pretty cool for them to be willing to directly help us if we need it, you know.
It's fascinating how connected they are to this. And I know Mike Mills played on, I think it's the second Split single album. He was the bassist on that. I mean, so Jason and Mike, Peace and Narduzzi, has a, you know, great relationship, obviously, with them. And, you know, there's, you know, he knows Peter Buck. And so there's a really nice interplay between this and that. And it's sort of blurring that line, because some people are like, well, isn't this just a tribute band? Like, but it's a sort of officially sanctioned other thing. Like, do you think of it as a tribute band?
It's hard. I don't think so. I don't think that, I don't think it is that. I think it's something different to that. And I don't, there's no costumes or, you know, any of that sort of stuff involved. It doesn't fall under that kind of act. I something about it feels like we've got, I think it feels good to have the full endorsement of REM. I think that bolsters us a little kind of spiritually.
Sure. And,
but I think we're really kind of, I don't know. I think we sense a kind of a, not an ownership of the music, but a stewardship of the music, I think, that is, that feels very vital and very strong. And they've just been so nice to us in terms of, they were down there in Athens. Not only they were, you know, had moments they've been on stage with us, but they sat and watched us and said things like, gosh, I've never seen us before, you know, and they just had a really wonderful, and they were kind of emotionally moved by what they saw. And so it's not a tribute act, you know, it's something slightly more than that. I don't know right. exactly what the word is, but no one's up there. We're playing the parts, you know, as best we can, but we're not afraid to take a few liberties with it, you know, slap it around a little bit if it needs it, you know, and it's just that we have a band mentality. I think
and Michael Shannon is not imitating Michael Stipe, and it's interesting because both Michaels have their own sort of unique kind of, I say this in a complimentary way, their own oddball sort of energy. Like they're each their own thing, you know. Like Michael Shannon is like an intense, unique, incredibly talented guy, whether he's on stage or screen or singing or acting or whatever, but he's not like sort of doing what Michael Stipe was doing when he was performing those songs. He's doing what Michael Shannon does when he performs those songs.
Exactly. I think it's got the spirit of how Michael Stipe presents himself on stage. And I think it's, it more responds to that kind of spirit, that expression, you know, I think that probably something that everybody in the band is doing, you know.
And you're playing a Rickenbacker.
Yes.
And Jason is playing a Telecaster, Fender Telecaster, at least there's one that I saw.
Yeah.
So you have two guys, like obviously they added a second guitarist for other shows later. They had Peter Holsapple, and then they had Scott McCoy for a long time.
Yeah.
It seems like you and Jason are doing more like both kind of two Peter Bucks. Are you learning Peter Bucks' parts? Are you and Jason kind of coordinating different parts, because sometimes on the record there would be more than one part, or how does that work with you guys?
We're taking the recordings and sort of breaking them down, like, you know, who's going to do a lead or who's going to do the main riff on that song, or who's, you know, sometimes we're playing the same thing. Sometimes one person will play acoustic and the other play electric. And yeah, you know, those recordings are layered, even those very early ones. There's a lot of different things going on. And that's been one of the most fascinating things about really, really digging into this music, because I can listen to it on my headphones while I'm learning stuff, or I can even listen to it on my phone. But then if I go in my car and listen to it, I hear something completely different. I hear something else emerging through the mix. So there's so much to track down and to kind of learn. But between Jason and I, and then also Vijay Telesnayak on keyboards, is also filling in other parts that aren't even necessarily keyboard parts. So I think we get a pretty good representation of what's on those recordings, from the first ones all the way to the later ones, which I say are a little bit more atmospheric and layered and things like that.
So when you get down to Riviera Maya, is that going to be the first time you guys have been together to play these new songs together?
Yeah, we'll have one. The way we've done it with this tour, all the tours, is we have one rehearsal before we go. Jason and I, because we're playing guitar, we'll get together probably once at my house and once at his house, go over each set that we're doing and kind of figure out. We've kind of noticed things differently than the other, you know, like, I think this riff goes like this, or you know, we've been able to put our brains together and kind of work stuff out that might have been ambiguous or hard to you know, kind of place. But we'll, Jason and I will get together. We might even get together with Vijay once before we go. And then, because everybody's so spread out, yeah, we have this chance to have like one all day rehearsal. And then I think we might do a thing for the upcoming tour, which starts in February. I think we might have a rehearsal, then maybe a day off or from Michael's voice to, you know, to rest up after one day. And then we hit the road. I have to look at the schedule, but that's kind of,
where does Vijay live? Cause
he's in Jason, Chicago.
So yeah. So you got three Chicago area people at least. Yeah. So that's good.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how many bands are you in right now?
Well, apart from this band, I'm in Expo 76, Courtesy Patrol, Sonic 45, Poi Dog Pondering, Sunshine Boys, still have the occasional show that we're doing. I think that's it. It seems like about five bands there, I guess.
You're not doing Tributosaurus anymore. That was a while ago.
Well, I do that every now and then. If, you know, there's a few shows that I do with them. Like they do Springsteen the night before Thanksgiving. I'm always involved in that. And if they do a Kinks show, I'm on that as well. But, they're doing stuff that's usually a little above my pay grade. You know, I can't get out there and play Yes or anything like that. So yeah, from time to time, I'll do stuff with them.
I tried to get you into EXTC. I did my best.
I remember that. That was an interesting, it seemed like it, you know, very close to happening.
The funny thing was, so the story on that, listeners, is that Terry Chambers' XTC tribute band with the original drummer was playing at Space in Evanston, and it was their first show. They'd been a four-piece with the lead singer, and the lead singer wasn't there for some reason, and it was their first show as a three-piece, and the lead guitarist was also taking all the lead vocals. And so at the intermission, I went up to the woman who was staffing the merch table, who maybe was Terry's partner, and I just said, look, I got this guy here, Doug, who's played all these parts, you know, doing you know, XTC shows like with Tributosaurus or whatever else. He just knows he just knows these songs. You should get him in for the second half. And she's like, oh, I'll ask the lads. And I don't know. Then I joined you guys. You and Jackie were sitting in the front, and I joined you at your table. I kept waiting for them to point and pull you up, but it didn't happen. But that was like from then on, it was just the three of them. Like the guy, the lead singer, never came back. And I think one of the other guys just left. But yeah, so I don't know what's happening with them now. But
well, you know, as a musician, that would have been a tough sell for me if someone said, "Hey, I got this guy. He really knows your stuff." You know, but I felt like, because every time a song would come up, I go, "Shit, man, I know this one. I know this one. I could do it." You know,
let me do No Thugs in Our House. Come on,
yeah, come on. Let me do Jason and the Argonauts. Let me do it. But that was a cool show. I guess I saw them another time at City Winery, and it was a nice thing to be in the same room as all those XTC people who thought, well, we'll never see this band. And you had Terry Chambers, who was great to watch, and he really was playing fantastically, I thought. And it was, I think it was a nice celebration. Now, I don't know if that's akin to what we're doing. I mean, because I know that when we're at these gigs, the reaction to what we're doing is just kind of universally euphoric. People who kind of got into REM after they broke up or whatever are super happy to see what's going on out there. And there's a natural curiosity with Michael Shannon, you know, at the front, like Michael Shannon sings, you know, and people come out. And I think what was very helpful for us was early on, I think the first round of touring that we did, we stopped in Minneapolis to do, that might've been our first show. And then we kind of went to San Francisco for Sketch Fest, and that kind of kicked a little bit of a runoff. But anyway, the reaction from people the first night that we played at First Avenue in Minneapolis, people were just saying basically like, if you're skeptical about this, if you're a non-believer, take our word for it. This thing is really, it's fantastic, you know? And the word from those sort of initial fans that came out and saw the show, I think spread. And I think it caused people all over to say, all right, I'll give this a shot. And it's been, you know, we're playing really nice sized places.
Yeah. I mean, so the first one was that Murmur anniversary show at Metro, right?
Now, I was not involved in that. Jason asked me to do it, and I would have done it in a heartbeat, but I had already scheduled a vacation. I took a sort of a solo drive through the Midwest. I went up the river and visited some friends along the way. And it was a rare thing that I was able to do it and had the time. And I regretfully said, I'm sorry, I can't do it. You know, I wish I could, but I held firm on kind of keeping that space kind of sacred, you know, just for my mental health and everything like that. And I was bummed to miss it, but I thought, oh, well, you know, that sounds like a fun gig. And I think you're probably aware of the story that after that show went on, people from all over the country, possibly the world, began reaching out to Jason and, you know, like, hey, can you bring this to our town? And they started looking at the possibility of it, and it worked out, you know?
Yeah. I mean, Jason and Michael have been doing these shows where they would do an album. Yeah. They've just done the Modern Lovers debut album earlier in the year, that same year. And I'd seen them do The Queen Is Dead. I think that was the first one I saw at Space before that.
I was on that gig.
Yeah. So there you go. I saw that one too. Yeah. Obviously this one blew up in a way that it doesn't seem like anyone really anticipated, which is kind of fascinating.
Well, we don't, you know, late night TV and stuff like that, which is really just incredible. So
yeah. How did you enjoy doing that? I'm just like, I know those guys. It was like Gerald was sitting in on drums that night. And
yeah, for the first one. Yeah.
Was that Seth Meyers?
That was the second one. I forget. That was, the first one was Seth Meyers. Yeah, and I think that was Gerald doing that one. Was it? Yeah, I think so. That was amazing. To me, that was...
Gerald Dowd, by the way.
Gerald Dowd, yeah. To me, that was an unbelievable day. Just knowing the kind of the mythology behind that whole building, to me, was incredible. Just to be walking in the same building that, you know, Bob and Ray used to work at and things like that. It was really... It was fantastic for me. I could not get over it, and it just had a really special feeling to me. So I was super happy to be a part of that. And then we came back and did Jimmy Fallon a year after that, which was just another incredible experience. Really right. Cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause you got your roots in TV also. You have all your MeTV stuff that you've done. And
yeah, my dad was a TV director and at WGN. And so I kind of spent a lot of time as a kid down there, did some commercials as a matter of fact, and sort of was raised with that showbiz environment, I guess.
So when you were growing up, did you think I'm going to be in showbiz, whether it's television or music or whatever?
Yeah, I felt that I'd end up in some area of it. Either my uncle was an overnight DJ in town, Wayne Jewell, and he did a lot of really kind of freeform stuff. It was super cool. And then he did a lot of writing and wrote some plays and did a lot of voiceover work and won some awards for some commercials that he wrote. And so the whole thing was part of growing up, was TV and radio, and then music came into my life when I was 12 or 13. And I knew that there was going to be some form of it or some bit of all of it that I wanted to do.
Right. So you grew up I have in my old notes, I'm actually going to read you something funny, but that the Slugs were formed in Park Ridge. Is that where you grew up, or where did you?
Yeah.
You grew up in Park Ridge.
Yeah. We formed that group with a friend of ours. And we were all working at a job, a TV job, an early version of pay sports TV called Sports Vision, which would come on, and you'd have a decoder on your TV set and you'd flip it over and you could watch at the White Sox game. And that was probably 83 or 84. But we didn't work till the evening. So we had our afternoons free and we all played music and we started just playing and our other friend Al started playing in his basement. And it's just sort of started that way, you know.
And you and your slightly older brother, Greg.
Yes. Greg, yeah, he plays bass, and he really got me, really leaned on me to play guitar when I was younger, and he was learning the bass, and I was a little resistant at first, but then I really threw myself into it, and really.
So, did the two of you like get into music together? Like, did you like the same bands, or did he like some stuff and you liked other stuff? And somehow, you know, he was always your older brother, even though he's not that much older. And
right, yeah, there's that. You know, he's only 11 months older, you know, but there's still. We're in separate grades in class, so there still was a division. We still had different kind of groups. I think he clung a little bit more tightly to kind of stadium rock or Zeppelin-y type of things, and I was more open to new wave when it came along. And it was a natural leap for me to get into new wave, and I really loved that. I think he was okay with it. I think it took him a little convincing, but we did start off, and I think, like, you know, the Beatles and our playing of guitar, all sort of that love of all that stuff kind of developed at the same time for both of us. You know, our earliest musical experiences together were looking at these songbooks with these $25 guitars that we bought on the same day and just hacking our way through that stuff.
Yeah. I was about to ask what your first guitar was.
It's made by either Kingston or Kauai, but it's called a Swinger. It's got a really weird shape to it. And I bought that, you know, with some birthday money for about $25 on a day that he was going to buy his first bass, a K bass, I think. And as the family was leaving to go to the music store, I ran back and got some money out of my drawer thinking, I don't know, something kicked in, you know, and it was hard to define, but I felt... so drawn to the guitar, just so drawn to it.
Was it electric guitar or acoustic?
Electric guitar, yeah. Okay. We each bought an electric, and we bought I think our mom bought us a $30 little plastic amplifier that had two inputs, so we could plug in and play, which was great. Yeah, and Greg still got it at his house, this K amplifier, but yeah.
So did you guys go home and immediately start playing music together, and you'd start strumming something, and he'd start... bopping along
on
the bass.
Yeah, once we figured out how to tune the guitars, and like I say, the Beatles songbook was there. It was already kind of, we knew how those songs were supposed to sound, so we could just kind of get the rhythm going and try to get the chord changes going as quickly as possible, and until it sounded something like a song in motion without any breaks in it, and the chords sort of sounding correct, you know. So that was initially how we worked, was just face to face on our twin beds across from each other, pounding away. And I was in a band before he was in a band. I was in a band that I joined, I think, the summer before my junior year in high school. I got asked to join a band, another band in Park Ridge, and that was like 1978. So I've been in a band ever since then.
You remember the first song you ever wrote?
The first song I ever wrote. I tried to write songs for this band, but I was so inept, and they didn't really mean anything. And I think I was goofing around with a friend of mine who had the lyrics, and I don't know why he had them, but the word was, "We are lucky. We are going to Kentucky on a houseboat." And, so I just put music to that. And that was my, you know, the first song that I really, really wrote. But I started writing in the Slugs because our other guitar player, Al, wrote a song. And that was like, oh man, I got to start writing songs, you know? And because I was up there by default singing, I didn't want to sing. but I knew the words and I was the only one idiotic and enough to just step up to the mic and go, okay, here we go. I got to do this. So I never was a singer. I was never very good. I was never in choir or anything like that. So I just did it, you know, learned on the job, basically.
There's some fun stuff you could find on YouTube. There's a version, Requiem for a Lightweight, live at Taste of Chicago, circa 1991.
Uh-huh.
You got a whole bunch of hair and you're just
a whole bunch of hair
and commanding the stage.
And shorts with cuffs on, you know, folded up jean shorts, probably. Great look, yeah.
Yeah. So this was probably the first time I ever talked with you, and this just makes us both old, but
yeah.
October 26, 1990, this is still online, even though it's by, the byline on this is contributed content. So this is basically how the Tribune Company has curated its old clips, but wow. I remember what this was, old contributed content, my nom de plume, made you were local heroes in the local music column that I had for the Friday section of the Tribune.
Sure, yeah,
before
yeah.
I'd even been hired there, by the way. Maybe that's why it's contributed content. But I don't know. I just had my name on it at the time. Anyway, you know, every week I'd sort of profile a different band, and I did the mm-hmm. Slugs. And so this is personnel, Dog Julin, vocals, guitar, Greg Julin, parentheses, Dog's Elder by 11 months.
Okay.
Bass, vocals, Mike Halston, drums, occasional vocals, formed March 5th, 1983, which is very specific.
Yeah. I think that might be, it's either, that might have been the time when Mike came over to Al's house with his drum kit to kind of meet us and play with us. We had signs up around music stores, you know, there used to be a Guitar Center up near Superdog, and we hung a sign up there, and I think his girlfriend got that and called us, and yeah, that's probably the date that Mike first came over, and it was sort of immediate, you know. Once we started playing Substitute by The Who, that was a sweet spot for all of us, and then we just assumed, well, he's in the band now, so yeah, right. March 5th, yeah, I guess that's the day.
Current lineup together since (1984) when the foursome became a permanent threesome. I assume that's when Al departed the band.
Al departed the band. Then we briefly had a guy called Tristan Gallagher, who was a singer that I met in the mod scene in Chicago, a British guy who was over here working, kind of bohemian guy. And we wrote some songs together, which was really very interesting for me, because he would write lyrics and melodies, and I kind of helped with some melodies and the chords and stuff like that. We arranged them together, and it was actually a good little, we lived in this flop house up on up in Uptown, and you know, it was a good productive little period that we had. But there was a little bit of division between Tristan and myself and Mike and Greg, and my ties to Mike and Greg, and then this new introduction of Tristan, who might have been a little critical of those guys. And it just didn't, it was fun and it was interesting. It could have been maybe something a little bit more, but it just wasn't working out, and he was restless, and we did the brave thing and had our quote manager fire him over the phone.
Wow. You got to the big time quickly.
Yeah, but it was an interesting period, you know. I enjoyed collaborating, and I haven't done a lot of that, and I'd really like to, but I haven't done too much, you know, writing with other people, but might be something that I'd like to try at some point.
What, at this point, when you have your band, the Slugs, and you're on your way up and you're gonna do your records for Pravda in the near future, what were your expectations or hopes for that band and that career?
Well, I think that there was so much indie rock, and not in the way that it sort of means something now, like they describe it as a type. I do indie rock. Well, when we were coming through, indie rock just really meant independent. It meant do it yourself. And getting back to REM, in the wake of REM's kind of explosion, it felt like college radio was also exploding, and it felt like all little labels were popping up and little scenes were developing all across the country and in you know, big towns and small towns and college towns. And I think we had hoped to maybe be a part of that circuit. And you know, there was a lot of those, you know, bands that rose to kind of be on bigger labels or get a little notoriety and things like that. So I think our aspirations were more towards that sort of approach. There was, you know, I know that I never have had aspirations for being on the top of the charts and make, you know, be nice. It would be nice to have make music that's popular. It'd be nice to make money off of music. But honestly, that wasn't the thing that was necessarily driving me. I was driven by wanting to write songs. I was driven to just kind of be good at something and find a means to express myself, basically. And the Slugs had an approach that was not polished. We didn't dress up and we didn't shake our asses around, and we weren't glamorous or anything like that. And there was an element when the sort of the Replacements came out, when that sort of looseness was something that was cool, and that was something we behaved that way anyway before we had really embraced them. So it just felt like maybe there's something for a quote unquote regular guy act, you know, that a regular guy group that's not, you know, flouncing around in pretty blouses and things like that with posh haircuts. I don't know if regular guys is the word, but we didn't have any pretense about us. I don't think we had a sense of humor, which could be, you know, a strike against you among some bands.
Well, you were definitely a fixture on that local scene. So I had this column from the beginning of 90 to beginning of 92. And then the Tribune finally hired me on the kid news section. And I got to write for 9 to 13 year olds for 2 years. Well, I still went to some shows and still wrote about some music, but not going out all the time like I was at that point and seeing bands like you guys and The Service, you know, which then morphed into the New Dunkin' Imperials, which had a more blatant sense of humor. But it was fun. But you guys totally made sense and in that scene, and were like thriving in that scene. And that was just the Chicago scene, and it happened to be the scene where, you know, Urge Overkill, which had a little more showmanship maybe, they're a different band, or Material Issue, like they were kind of coming out of it, and then you sort of didn't know. The rest of it was sort of a crapshoot. Like some bands I thought were the best bands, you know, they stayed like these great Chicago bands, and some became more notorious. I was like, oh, I didn't see that one coming.
By the time that scene, that sort of national notoriety came to Chicago, those years of, like you said, Urge Overkill,
and Pumpkins
and Liz Phair, Material Issue, and all these people that are getting these big national deals, and, you know, rightfully so, we were probably a little overripe at that time. We probably had been kicking around for the better part of 10 years, and maybe to some extent seemed past our freshness date. And, you know, we had a kind of internal tensions within the band that seemed to be a regular part of what we were doing. And, you know, it by the time that these national, big time recording contracts were being offered to Chicago people, it just sort of felt like we were the guys that were just sort of holding the door for everybody else. Mm-hmm. That's how we sort of felt about it all. And we didn't, in hindsight, we didn't have the material. We didn't have the look. We just had something that was like immediate, and it was in the moment, you know? So if you were at a show, like one of our famous 3.5 hour shows at Shuba's, it was a really fun event. There was nothing staged or show busy about it. It was just like this real expression. And I think there are a lot of people who appreciated that. And I still hear from people, and I still meet people who talk about how much the Slugs meant to them. And you know, that's really nice to hear. We were doing our best, you know, we were trying to write songs and play them well. And, you know, I think just about the time when I figured out how to write for us, when we had been together with Johnny Allen guitar for a while, by the time I figured out how to write for two guitars and material was getting stronger, we just kind of fizzled out, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Were you bitter about it at the time?
It was complicated because at some point I was asked to join Poi Dog Pondering.
Right. I was wondering, I was going to ask you about the timing of that next.
So. Yeah. And that didn't sit well with the other guys, I think, you know, for the most part. I know that my being in Poi Dog is a different type of music. I wanted to be a better musician than I was. I saw these guys and I had an immediate friendship with everybody involved in Poi Dog, and I just felt like I wanted to not be the front guy for a little while. I wanted to develop my skills more as a guitarist, you know, and sure, the gigs were the shows were bigger, and there were theaters, and there were, you know, tours on buses and stuff like that. There was all those things which I had sort of seen from afar. And it was nice to be involved in that, but it was nice to be respected as a musician and play all this kind of new material and develop my playing a little bit more. I couldn't just crank it out and bash away like I might have done before. So it was part of it, my development as a musician, you know, playing with them. It caused some tension within the Slugs for sure.
I'm dusting off the old ghosts now, and they're giving me a run for my money. I'm down here with the skulls and bones, down here in the catacombs.
Did you like the sort of groove-based kind of songs you were doing there? Was there any opening to sort of write stuff too, or was it really like it was Frank's vision of what the band sounded like?
It's definitely his vision, but there was lots of room, especially on the Pomegranate album, for contribution, you know, for writing a bridge here and there, helping out with some chords and things like that, which was great. And I had, you know, my input was welcomed, and it made it on the records and stuff like that. So I had liked some of the sort of more kind of soulful stuff that they were doing. And again, I wanted to be able to play that sort of stuff legitimately, you know, and I had a certain style that I was very comfortable in, but then to learn to, there's so much going on. There's so many people in Poydog that the main thing was just to shut up and listen. That's one of the main things that I got out of that, and know when to come in. It took me a while to learn that. I was still playing loudly and a little bit recklessly, I think, but over time, I think I developed it. There was an era of Poydog after a time when the lineup was changed and the nature of the material got a lot more kind of trancy and electronic,
right, I remember
and
that.
Stuff like that, which is a good sonic kind of listening experience if you're in the right mood for it. I don't think I had, I was not involved in that. And, you know, it makes sense. You know, I was not particularly, it's not where I would go for listening pleasure necessarily, top of my list. And I didn't know what I would be able to add to that kind of stuff. So, but then Poydog being Poydog, it's all morphed back together now. And what the modern version of Poydog is, at least at the last time I played a gig with them, was it's everything. It's like every phase of the band is represented on every, you know, on every show, and with the personnel are people that have been there from the very beginning and people who are recently joined. So it's as amorphous and evolving, but also true to it. I mean, that seems to be the nature of the band from the beginning, is that it's opened over to new people and new ideas. And then Frank kind of steers it, you know.
How often are you playing with them now?
Not often at all. We have, I think, maybe one big Chicago show per year. And there's a couple of out of town things that, because of what it costs. Well, they played in Austin recently, and there's still Poydog people in Austin. So they played with those guys, and a few people from Chicago went down and played it. You know, again, it's this big hybrid that looks different each time.
So coming out of that, did that change what you wanted to do?
Well, there was a period when I joined the band, there was this question, oh, is Sony Records going to keep the band going? They, you know, they might've run out of their contract or whatever. And so is Sony going to keep them? And they dropped them, you know, and then there was a kind of attempt to get on some other labels and things. So I think I was probably a little stereotypically like, ooh, am I going to be able to be a full-time musician now? Like, are we going to get on some label and get some promo and get, you know, on the radio apart from XRT and tour and stuff like that? But it never happened. And what happened was the band found its rightful place and its strong place as a fully independent operation, you know, with,
right.
And Frank, God bless him. If there's a situation he needs solving, if there's a thing he's got to figure out in terms of getting something distributed or put out or whatever, he learns how to do it. And he's done that all along, whether from making cassettes and in his bedroom and hand drawing the covers and getting them out in the streets to, you know, recording and distributing a record. He's figured all that stuff out, and he's got a scrappiness and a tenacity, and you know, he's a true artist, and he's a fighter.
Tell me about your songwriting, like, over the years. Like, are you someone who writes songs all the time and then figures out what to do with them? Or do you sort of say, hey, I've formed this band, the Sunshine Boys, mm-hmm. and I need to write material for that band. So I'm project oriented as opposed to just songwriting oriented all the time.
Well, I write all the time, and I always have, and I'm still doing it now. And there are songs that are going to end up in different things or different collections or for different uses. I don't know. Or they'll just sit in my hard drive until I die. But with Sunshine Boys, we came together as a sort of a backing band for a couple of guys, Brett Nouveau and Rich Sparks, who...
The Last Afternoons.
The Last Afternoons, TLA.
There you go.
That back then they were called Sex Ritter. They wanted us to play. They asked Frida to play drums with them. They asked me to play guitar. And then they asked Jason Narducci to play bass. And I think he might have shown some interest initially, but then he's got so much going on. He said, you know, I can't do it. And they told me about that. I said, okay, we don't know each other that well, but you have to trust me on this. We have to get Jackie Schimmel on bass because she is a fantastic, fantastic player, melodic and just so inventive, like Revolver era McCartney inventive, and just great, and is a great editor. And she's called the Stickler. That's her nickname. So
she
gives you the straight dope. Anyway, I said, trust me, let's get Jackie in on her. And they said they were cool to that. And so when we started playing together, the three of us noticed that there was something going on, that the three of us had a natural sound that we locked into. And when it became like, when I started bouncing the idea off of these guys, like, you want to form a band? You want to break away and form a band? They were into it. And that alone was the biggest inspiration for my writing. Like, once I heard the sound that we made together, you know, Frida plays those drums so sort of hypnotically, and there's a great groove there. She's got such a natural kind of swing and right. groove to the way she plays.
Yeah, she's got a great feel. Like, she's not like this sort of Keith Moon-esque fancy, you know, no. bowl you over. She just has a really nice feel for this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
And also, she and Jackie are also super nice people and cool to be around.
Great people. And the way Jackie and I had played together for years and years, another she recorded on an album that I made, and we did all sorts of live stuff together when Shubas had these things called Hoot Nights. So I've known her for a long time. I know how great she is. And when we started playing together, there was like, it just worked with my guitar sound. It just worked so well. And I was so happy to be in a group with those two who not only are just great people, but what the way we worked was just so, it was down to business. You know, there was no, we didn't jam, we didn't goof around, we didn't, you know, we didn't necessarily like write riffs and turn them into songs. Like, I came in with the songs, but they arranged them. And once I had that sound in my head, I just was like, I was off to the races. I just wrote and wrote and wrote, because everything that I was writing, I knew that they would make it so much better, and it was going to be a great thing for us. And I appreciated being in a band that had female energy, if you will. They were there to work, you know. They were there to work, and that's what I'm not always the guy that's keeping the, you know, sometimes I've, for many times in the past, I've been the main goof off in rehearsal. But for this group, we'd rent a rehearsal space for 3 hours, you know, ahead of a gig or something. And we'd be done in 90 minutes, or, you know, just because we were just so efficient. And so I was a very productive period for me, because I just knew that I could give them the next song, and they would either say, no, that doesn't work, or let's do it. And then it would be but put this bridge there or cut this in half or do this twice. And the instincts were great and the relationship was great. And it was so kind of yes. And, you know, there wasn't,
right.
we never had any huffy moments or any fights or any arguments, you know. It was all really nice. And our records got recognition, which was something that meant it was so exciting for me. I'd never really gotten that before, you know, like album of the year or, you know, people writing about us, you know, Ira Robbins writing about us and all this stuff was like, to me, that was almost just like, wow, man, I made it. All the times I watched other people make it, I finally got, you know,
it's such affirmation to like,
yeah,
you've been around people like you, people like, you know, Frida was the Blake Babies drummer way back when, and yeah. Jackie's been playing stuff and she's been fantastic. I saw her first, I think, with Justin Roberts. Part of what's cool about Sunshine Boys is that it's a band certainly in Chicago that like you guys are well loved by everyone. Like people root for you because everyone's like, oh, they're like nice, good people.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a lot of warmth towards us, and people would say, you know, I got a friend of mine said, you know, I knew you guys were making a record, I knew it was going to be good, but I didn't expect it to be so fucking great. You know, people were just like, well, you know, they could have thought, oh, these three people who've been around for a while, they put together a little group, haven't they? And I think they were surprised that we came out, and we were kind of, I don't know if ferocious is the word, like we meant it. We went out there and we meant it, you know, we delivered and we played full on and it was wonderful. It was great. A great thing for us was when we went on tour through the Midwest with Juliana Hatfield, Frida's former bandmate in Blake Babies. And so it was a great gig to have, a great tour to be on, because we knew that there'd be some, that we knew musically we were like-minded and there would be a lot of people appreciating Frida and Juliana being together, as it were, again, you know, one more time. Blake Babies fans could see these guys, right, playing together. So, and we went out there every night, and every show the crowd really responded. They responded so positively. And that was nice. So, you know, COVID shut everything down, but then I did feel like, gosh, I think that's really all I ever wanted out of my career, was to go in there and be a confident band that blows people away, to have our songs listened to and understood and people took them to heart. You know, it was people understood what we were writing about and singing about. And that's all I've ever wanted, you know? So it was a really nice thing. And it was tough to reboot after COVID and Frida retired from drumming, but she really encouraged us and she encouraged me and said, you know, get Gerald to play. He loves it. He's going to do well. And I'll play tambourine every now and then. So, you know, we have some new material and we'll see what happens with that. I'd like to get some stuff recorded. It's be kind of busy this year, but I want to find some time to get some stuff recorded. So Gerald Dowd has been great. Of course, that's what he does for a living, is be great.
Yes. So, he's fantastic. Yeah. He's like Chicago's own Jim Keltner.
He is. Yeah. Yeah. And the problem with Dowd is that if you play with him, then you're going to beg him to be in your group. And chances are he's going to say yes, because he's such a nice guy. But, He's a wonderful guy.
He does a lot of work too. But yeah. Do you have Sunshine Boys shows coming up this year?
Nothing booked. We had an offer for something a couple nights ago, but Gerald was out of town, so we couldn't take it. But yeah, we'll see. I can't sort of pick anything. I'm going to be on this tour. It's going to be
right.
Probably won't be able to do anything until maybe early summer, late spring, something like that.
But you've been writing songs in the meantime.
I've been writing songs. Yeah, we've got a number of songs that are good to go, and I think they serve our legacy proud, and I think they push it a little bit farther along, you know.
Nice.
So we'll see. And, you know, Gerald's adds another, you know, singing voice to the band too. So that's very, very good. We can, you know, a trio that all sings is a pretty, pretty good thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. So Blue Music and Work and Love, yeah, all of those songs are credited to Sunshine Boys.
Yeah.
So you came in with them and then everyone put them together, but it's sort of, is that kind of the spirit of REM, where they just shared everything and it sort of, they were not going to break down who wrote what?
I like seeing it that way better. If you listen to a demo of one of our songs, it's pretty much there. But they were so inventive in writing their parts and in making the edits to the songs that it really did feel like a group effort. So I wanted it credited to all of us, and you know, everyone is in on the publishing, you know, such as it is.
So, which is very nice, though. But so many bands broke up because of fights over publishing and songwriting.
Yeah, I know. That's another getting, like you said, back to REM. That was the smartest thing in terms of their long-term friendship. And I think, I'm not sure if it was universally accepted straight away, or if it turned into a thing where, well, gosh, you know, I wrote this whole song. Don't you think I should get credit for it? But I think by sticking by that, they've remained one of the things, and also them being wonderful, wonderful guys that I think that's helped maintain their friendship.
They're still friends. You know, a lot of these bands, whether they break up or not, they're not friends. A lot of them are not friends when they're still playing together, but it seems like, I mean, I just saw a post earlier today. Oh, we just had our band dinner, and there's a picture of all of them at dinner.
I know.
I'm like,
it's like, you know,
it is cool. Like, just as a total aside, it's just cool when like the band because I had bands that I was really into, but they were like older than me. Like, I loved the Beatles, but I missed the Beatles, you know. It's like they'd broken up before I got into music, but I was like, oh my God, what it would have been like to like hear Sgt. Pepper or the White Album or Abbey Road when it was released or and stuff like that. And so it was more like this, the band that I really got onto from the beginning, at least the first album, I didn't know Chronic Town, but I got on with Murmur and saw them on every tour, and I was just like, oh, they're like evolving in this really cool way, and they keep putting out music, and they seem like really good guys. And then I've talked to a bunch of them, and I think I've talked to somehow or other all of them at some point, but they're all like, oh, you know, meet your idols, they're really cool. That's a nice thing.
They're all great, and they greet each other with hugs, when they say goodbye, they say I love you, and they hug each other. And I mean, and I think you're bringing up the Beatles is that's how it felt to me, in terms of the influence they had, what they meant for other bands, how it would not have been the same with any other personnel, and the time that they came out, I liken them to the Beatles in that regard, the location, the personnel, the time, you know, what was going on and what they meant for other bands and certainly for college radio. And
they've all done accomplished stuff since then, but none of them was going to sound the same without the other three.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Even, and even the later stuff when Bill Berry wasn't there, was a little different, but there's still, mm-hmm. still some great songs in there.
It always felt like they were aware of how much they mean to an awful lot of people. And they're very gracious about that, you know, and they're very quick to not put out any airs or have any kind of rock star pomposity about them in any regard.
Sunshine Boys is a band name. Were you like a Walter Matthau, George Burns fan, or was this just like, it's sort of ironic because it's you and two women when you formed it?
It started off as a kind of an aside when I first met Frieda, and we were talking about because we had, the Slugs had opened up for the Blake Babies at Lounge Acts, but we never met each other. But when we started talking about all these clubs and all these people and all these records that we kind of knew and were kind of experiencing at the same time in different areas, it was like, oh, this is like, the Sunshine Boys movie, when they're talking about all the old theaters that they played and all the old artists that they worked with, you know, Lady, Lady, Be My Baby and all that stuff, the Belasco Theater. It just sounded like two old showbiz people getting together and talking. And it was just like, well, if we ever start a band, we'll call it the Sunshine Boys. Ha, ha, ha. And it was, that was as deep as it got, you know? And then when it came time to form the band. Yeah. It was funny. The fact that it was two women and one man, and it's like, yeah, sure. And they got it right away. They laughed about the name, and no one kicked back about, well, I'm a girl, I don't want to be called the Sunshine Boys. There's nothing like that. It was just so off the cuff, and it stood out, you know, it stood out for several reasons, but yeah, it was nothing thought out at all, really.
Hey, you know, the Beach Boys can call themselves Beach Boys at age 80. You guys can call yourself Sunshine Boys at whatever you want. And you left off the just to trip people like me off. Like, no, yeah. It's Talking Heads and Sunshine Boys.
Exactly. That's our one little bit of our artistic movement there. Yeah, no the. But I don't know. I don't even know how that happened. I think probably, I don't even know, maybe because of the movie or the play or whatever, that's got a the. I have no idea. But I know there are dozens of other groups call that. And I got my Spotify year-end rap or something for the artist. You know, I was like, oh, let's see what your number one song was. And it was by some sort of old-timey Western band called Sunshine Boys, you know.
That you'd been listening to?
No. This was like... listed the songs that were played by Sunshine Boys. I was like, which one of my songs?
The stuff you were listening to.
Yeah, no, like, no.
You just happened to be a big fan of some old-timey other band called Sunshine Boys. That's a big coincidence. So
yeah, no. So it's been used before several times.
As I continue to run down connections, you also were on stage for one of the earlier live interview shows I did at Space pre-Caropop. When I was doing Talking in Space, and I had Len Casper and then the first ever show of the 45, soon to be Sonic 45, was that night after the end of my interview with him.
That's correct.
And that was you.
Yeah.
You were there.
Yeah. That's a band I love playing with because I'm just a guitar player. I don't even think I've been given a microphone to sing. Maybe I have, but it's been a while since we played. I love playing that. And that's a big, powerful, bright sound and kind of like the Cult, things like that. And it's super, super fun to play that stuff. It's straight ahead, very propulsive, very melodic. And it's a big, bright sound. And it's got a little bit of darkness to it, which is really, really cathartic and fun. And I love that role in that band of just playing the guitar and playing these kind of signature riffs and playing these spacey kind of echoey solos and things like that. It's very, very satisfying. And if the group themselves weren't so disagreeable and such pains in the ass, no, they're all tremendous folks, you know, Gerald Dowd, Liam.
So Len Casper, at the time I talked to him, was the Cubs television play-by-play announcer, and he had been for many years. He has since gone back to his first love, which is radio, and he's been the White Sox radio play-by-play guy for a few years now. But he also is a really nice bassist and songwriter, and so you guys have done two albums of his songs, and it's kind of this Chicago all-star band, boosting this all Chicago all-star in Len Casper. And I was going to ask you about the idea of like helping him see that dream come. You know, he has a very successful public career, and he clearly also had this dream where he's an artist and he writes songs and stuff. And I would think there would just be something extra satisfying about just helping him achieve his vision, because it's a pretty, you know, specific vision.
He is, in addition to being obviously incredibly knowledgeable about sports, he is one of the most well-read people and one of the most musically astute people. He is just a lifetime learner and loves nothing more than exploring a new group and getting to know them. So he would kind of put together, back when there was a charity that would be working, the foundation to be named later, which was
the Hot Stove Cool Music.
The Hot Stove Cool Music Show between Boston and Chicago. I was lucky enough to start playing with that group, and
you're in the Chicago All Stars for that.
Yeah. And so we would, we'd fly out there and do those benefit shows, and we do stuff here in Chicago. It's really, really, it was so much fun. But it was great because, like I said, Len is a super musical guy, and when he started laying these demos on me, I was like, this stuff is really good. He made really good recordings, and he just had a natural kind of, his stuff was just very naturally like, it had a kind of a very appealing sound. I mean, it was very compelling, and the personalities put together with this band, I think it's spot on. And everybody really kind of has the ability to kind of translate these songs in a way that I think is very satisfying to him. I think he's really pleased that everybody's there and they're so into it. And, you know, it's because of his season and because of everybody else's work lives and commitments, it's hard to kind of get momentum going, unfortunately, you know, right. for a band, but it does feel like a band. It doesn't feel like a project, God forbid. It doesn't actually feel like a band. It's just that we've been having problems with momentum because of the way things work out. But when we do get together, it's fantastic. But I think it's been, he's very, you know, he's a very calm, cool, professional man when he's behind the mic, but he's just so enthusiastic about this stuff when it comes up and it's sounding, and he's just so appreciative, you know. And
it's a great guy. There's a great vibe coming off that stage.
Yeah.
You know, and the songs are really personal too. And
yeah, they are.
You know,
that's,
and he's like generally, and I'm, you know, I mean, I know him, but you know, he's a pretty, like, in general, he's, you know, he's a fairly guarded guy in terms of, like, he's not just someone who's going to, like, look at me. I'm just going to, like, hold forth on all these topics or something like that.
Right.
And so hearing him reveal so much through the music is really cool.
It is cool.
You know, and doing it with you guys, who, again, it's another one of these things where people are like, oh, I know him, and now they get them together, and it's like, it's an all-star band. But it's a band.
You're right. The way that he writes it is really personal. You know, there's some very personal information in a lot of those songs. And he's a great friend of mine. And he's, you know, we go out to dinner quite a bit. It's with our wives, and we have a great relationship. And he's a good man.
Nice. This has been fantastic. And it's been so much fun to talk to you in the official Carol Pop mode, as opposed to just, you know, grabbing you at some show that you've played at or we're both in the audience for. But do you have other shows? I mean, again, you have like these REM related shows and tours. Do you have like Expo 76 stuff coming up?
We got a few months off because I'll be gone. I think all the stuff that I do, we'll return in April. Expo will be at Simon's in Chicago on the second Wednesday. And the group that I play in called Courtesy Patrol is another cover band. It's even, I think, a little more free form than Expo 76. It's kind of no set list. And it's with Chris Neville and John Paul from Tributosaurus and Jason Batchko on drums. And it's just a lot of fun. We play at a small little saloon called the Friendly Tap the third Thursday of every month. And it's a wonderful, joyous, freeform night of music, you know.
I love playing with those guys.
No, it's a good band, and those are such great players.
I remember John Paul kicking Colin Moulding, you know, he was doing a great Colin Moulding when you guys did XTC at Martyrs many years ago.
Yeah,
I was like, who is that guy? Because he's nailing those Colin Moulding bass parts.
Yeah, that's
John Paul.
That's John Paul. That's what he does.
And Expo 76 is like sort of a big band with horns and stuff.
Yeah, a lot of times most times we have horns. Sometimes we just play the four of us, and that's just a band that I started with. I had this idea, and I talked to Kenny Goodman from Pravda Records. He's our keyboard player, been my friend for 40 years, and we were touring with Andre Williams in Europe, and you know, doing all this stuff, and I just was like, wouldn't it be great to have a band, a cover band, where you could play whatever you want and you wouldn't feel like, you know, offing yourself after a gig because you had to play these songs you hate, you know? And we just, you know, put it together. I found John Carpenter, who I'd known for a while, and on drums, and Ralph Baumel was a guy I went to high school with. He plays bass. And I just started bouncing the idea off all these guys, and they were like, okay. They'd never met each other. Nobody in the band had ever met each other. It's like, I got this nutty idea. We're just going to play whatever we like, and let's just be great, and then things will happen. And that's been a much loved, and it's a successful band, and we get along great, and you know, it's a family scene for us too. So it's, you know, I'm not at the top of the charts, but my musical experiences are really rewarding for me in my life, you know, and I feel grateful for that. And I'm not going to lie, that before this year's over, I'd like a top 10 single.
There you go.
A couple of them. But I need to get this house paid off. So,
all right. Well, we'll talk later. Cause I got some, you know, hit singles that I haven't, you know, released.
Okay.
Had recorded yet. And, you know,
we'll
come up with some pseudonymous band. There'll be like anime band members. So they won't.
So it's a modern approach.
It'll rip off Gorillaz, but it'll be a modern approach anyway. Okay. So that would be great. I was going to ask you just sort of as sort of a final question, just what it is that motivates you in music at this point.
What motivates me is trying to get to the things that I've thought of, like, oh, that looks like that might be fun, or I really want to do something like that. I'm trying to eliminate the word want from my life. I'm trying to substitute it with action. I don't want to sit here and want stuff. There's a lot of things that I feel that I can be doing with music, and I'm just trying to get to them. I've got a number of different things in half completed or fully completed states, with a number of concepts, whatever. I just want to keep doing it. I'm entering my golden years, and I'm not getting any younger, but I feel like I'm singing and playing and writing as best as I've ever done in my life. So I don't know. I want to keep doing it. I would like to say something simple or you know, even say something like, yeah, I want to make money, which I do, but I'm just trying to not want, but to actually just do.
That's it for episode 211 of Caropop. Thanks so much to Dog Julin for letting us vicariously enjoy his far-ranging career. The 22-date U.S. leg of Michael Shannon and Jason Narducci and Friends tour of REM's Life Search pageant kicks off February 11th in Denver and winds up with sold-out shows at Metro in Chicago on March 12th and 13th, a March 14th date at First Avenue in Minneapolis, and a March 16th show at Bluebird in Bloomington, Indiana. Look for tickets at concertedefforts.com. Go to dogjulin.com to learn more about him, including his work on the Steve Dahl Show podcast, and go to sunshineboys.net to learn more about that excellent band, and be sure to pick up copies of their albums Blue Music and Work in Love. Follow Dog on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Caropop is produced by Chris Swake, who is Superman, and he can do anything. Thanks to all who support Caropop. If you'd like to throw something into the Caropop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. And I'll give you a shout-out on the next episode. Please go to caropop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Caropop on the so-called socials at CaroPopcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe here and on YouTube, tell your friends, and return next week for another Caropop conversation. Thanks.